Good evening, folks, and welcome to the April edition of Page Turner Podcast. With me, as always, is the effervescent Rob Roy McCandless. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Kari. How are you doing today?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing all right. It's a nice weekend. Yeah.
Well, it's spring now.
Yeah, it has sprung. So, yeah.
Finally, and the sun's out. Sun's out, buns out. Fun's in, Rob. Nobody wants to see that.
I need a lot more color before anybody. Yeah, that's not good. Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't help it. I'm giddy with sunshine.
That's great. That's all that vitamin D is going straight to your head.
It really is. Better than my thighs. I'm especially excited today because I'm excited about today's guest because she is a fellow BC girl. Finally, the odds are in my favor. Two Canadians, one American, finally.
So
just for this month only.
It's only half of a fair fight.
Our guest today's name is Karen Jansen. Like I said, she's a fellow BC girl, and she wrote a beautiful book called Grow, Cook, Eat, Share, and it's about homesteading. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. We loved your book.
Thank you.
Yeah, we did. No, it was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's great to hear.
Before you came on the show, I described it as pretty. And let me elaborate. Yeah. You know what? This book made me happy. It sort of had a very Little House on the Prairie vibe to it. Didn't you think, Mark?
Yeah, and I was saying it was kind of a almost lyrical, because you break up the book into essentially four parts, the four seasons, which makes sense because it's a book about, you know, not off the grid homesteading rugged life, but really just kind of following the seasons and getting back to that kind of a lifestyle. And so it kind of had a lyrical quality to it, like, it's spring and here's all the neat things about spring, which I think was my favorite chapter of the whole, or the section of the whole book.
Oh, love it.
Well, what I'm interested in is in today's technological based world, I mean, everybody's just, they're into their phones, they're into their laptops. Now they've got this like virtual reality glasses. Have you seen those, Rob?
No, like actual, like Cylon glasses where like you can have rain and.
Yeah.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Oh, anyway.
I'm in.
What made you decide to kind of, you know, go back to like the farming roots, homesteading and sort of give it all up? Did you give it all up and go homestead? Or tell us about the process. What happened?
Yeah, for sure. You know, even as a kid, I always dreamed of an acreage full of animals and a big garden. I did not grow up like that whatsoever. Okay. So, you know, as much as you can dream about it, the reality and learning all of the skills is totally different. But it really started early on. And then my husband was on board when we had our first kid. We thought, this is crazy. Like, what are we feeding him? These cans and pouches and baggies and all this processed food. So we thought, okay, well, we could probably do it better. And we started as foodies. That was kind of our thing. And then we thought, well, if we're passionate about good food, then we should probably know where it comes from. And that just sort of snowballed into, well, if we know where it comes from, why don't we just try growing it or producing it ourselves? Again, okay, we had no clue what we were getting into.
So where did you live?
We started in Vancouver.
Okay.
So we were downtown, and then we thought, we want to have another kid. And it's a little crazy trying to raise kids in the city. So we moved out to Abbotsford, actually, which is about an hour out of the city, out of Vancouver. And just, we were on a city lot, nothing fancy, but we just decided, let's put in a few garden beds and see where it goes from there.
Okay, so you started garden beds in a city lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously you expanded because you've got goats, you've got chickens, So then what happened?
Yeah, so we started looking into having urban chickens and came up against all these bylaws with, you know, no chickens in the city, all these different rules and regulations. And so we started our acreage hunt. And meanwhile, like, just we're learning skills because homesteading, right? Like, yes, it's about acreage, but it's also about skills. So mm-hmm. we started really being intentional about learning to make food from scratch and canning and processing and doing all of these fun kind of experiments in the kitchen, pouring into fermenting. So it felt like a bit of a science lab in our kitchen at times where we've got all these things brewing and bubbling. And then, yeah, when we found our acreage, we just knew that's the one. And we had big dreams and really little clue of reality of what it would take to get to where we are now.
How much, I think you mentioned it in the book, but how much acreage do you actually have now?
Yeah, we only have a 5-acre parcel and only about 2.5 of those acres are usable land. So it's quite a small footprint for homesteading. But in a way, I think it almost makes it easier because you have to get creative about what and where you can do things. And it sort of just forces you to think, okay, what's the most efficient way to plant or to have the animals? And really that kind of opened our eyes to the idea of permaculture. Like, how can we create a miniature ecosystem on our tiny little homestead property?
I'm obsessed with permaculture.
So great.
No, I live in Poco on ALR. So like I have a greenhouse and gardens and chickens and goats. We're friends on Facebook, so I'm sure you've seen all that.
Mm-hmm,
And permaculture is so interesting in the sense that it doesn't destroy, because agriculture, I don't know if you know this, Rob, agriculture actually, it hurts land.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because, you know, you can only grow so many crops before your land, it goes fallow and you have to add things. You have to add fertilizer. You have to add. Permaculture is sort of creating like a living food forest
mm-hmm.
or like a living food area. So it works symbiotically with the water, with the trees, with the bushes, with the dirt. So I find permaculture, I'm just obsessed with permaculture.
Yeah.
So I'm glad. So that's what you're doing now, is you're more less agro, more perma.
Yeah, we started off with our intention of being that way. I had done some research on it and like knew that was right up our alley, where right. everything is working together instead of, like you said, instead of depleting nature, we want to be building it.
Enhancing it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And when you start to realize that everything works together and you can actually, there's this relationship of like 1 + 1 = 3, right? Like you're creating so much more than if you just had a big monocrop field here and only animals over on the other side. So when you kind of marry them all together, you get amazing things.
What resources did you draw from? You said you started doing research on it to try to learn about it. Did you already know about that, or did you like start down the path and then you're like, oh, I've got to start looking into this?
Yeah. So what I didn't mention earlier is that two books that really kind of opened my eyes, I guess I'd say, to what permaculture is and what sustainable type agriculture is. And this is like maybe 12 or 15 years ago, Animal Vegetable Miracle by Barbara Kingsolver,
which is a memoir. Yeah, I've heard of that.
So,
yeah,
so good. And then the second book that just kind of pushed me and my husband over the edge was The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan.
You mentioned it in the book. You mentioned that one in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. That sort of kind of tweaked us to realize like there's so much more to growing and producing food than just having these giant crops.
Rob, are you still there?
I'm here. Yeah.
I hear some kind of background something going on.
My air conditioner just kicked on. Hot that my upstairs office, the air conditioner kicked on. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Was that what that was?
I hope so. I hope it wasn't something else, we're probably being listened to by Russians.
Probably because as you know the government doesn't want you to grow food.
Right?
Coming for you, Karen. Run. Speaking of which, I mean, if there ever is any some kind of apocalypse, you know, you've got the handy skills. What would you say is the most important skill for somebody to have, or mind thought, or for somebody who's thinking of, you know, leaving their condo in Vancouver and buying a plot of land somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple at the top of my list. I'd have a really hard time narrowing it down to just one. But I will just say, and maybe, like, I hope your vegetarian listeners, if there are any, aren't going to hate me, but animal husbandry is the key to a sustainable homestead.
Oh!
So if you know how to raise animals, because that's your fertilizer.
Yeah.
So they're gonna if you have fields, fallow fields, if you're doing any sort of crop rotation, you can throw them in there. They can clean up your garden or your field. They're gonna leave manure, so it's gonna enhance the soil so that you don't have to bring in like chemical fertilizers. And then really they're the most nutrient dense. So in the case of, you know, being in some sort of crisis, like you mentioned, apocalypse thing, animals are going to be able to sustain you food-wise in a way that you just can't survive off of the kind of plants we grow. Like maybe some places where they're able to grow wheat and that sort of thing, but a lot of places aren't capable of growing the types of foods that we're used to getting in the store. And the amount of acres that it would take to grow a field of lentils or beans, for example, right, to get the protein is going to take so much more resources than to have a small field with a few goats on it.
This is an interesting argument. Because you know, it's always the meat eaters versus the vegetarians. I mean, nobody can just respect each other, right? Like, hey, you have a choice and I have a choice, and let's just be friends anyway.
Yeah, totally.
You know, this is one of the big arguments, is that the meat eaters will say, you know, the vegetarians will say, no, it's better for the planet to not eat meat. And the meat eaters will say, well, you know, by the time they finish, like, growing all your lentils and your tofu, you know, you're taking way more water and land than it takes to raise animal feed.
Yeah.
So that's a real, so do you agree with that, or?
I do. I mean, I've done some research. I wouldn't say that I'm an expert, but from what I've read, and I just want to clarify too here, is that there's a big difference between 10,000 head of cattle on a ranch that are all, you know, grain fed versus small scale beef that is grass finished.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Where they're really taken care of and they're fed only food that their system is meant to eat.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that just because I agree that animal protein is vital, I'm not in favor of big egg either. So I'm finding myself
kind of the
somewhere in no man's land where not a lot of people agree with what I do on either side.
Well, and that's kind of the Little House on the Prairie kind of
vibe.
Come back to that where there just wasn't much of a choice. You needed grains, you needed vegetables, but you also needed the meat. And the best way to get that kind of protein is from an animal. That's the
And
so if you have that Little House, you know, kind of mentality, then you solve most of those problems. Not all the problems, but you solve most of those problems.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of large scale meat production. Have you done any research into, I've read a lot about, I shouldn't say a lot, but I started reading some stuff about regenerating grasslands with cattle.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
I don't know a lot about it, but what I've read, like the research that's coming out of that is pretty exciting. And one, organization that's doing a lot of the research in the U.S. is called the Rodale Institute.
Okay.
And they might be someone worth looking into. They kind of do a lot of side-by-side comparisons of, you know, organic crops grown versus regular commercial crops and that sort of thing. So it's pretty neat to see what people are doing and the research that's coming out of it. The unfortunate thing is that it's still, you know, it's a minority type of thing. Like the majority of people aren't either aware of it or on board with it. So,
yeah. It's such a slippery slope of a subject because, you know, you really do. Cause you get like, I am an animal lover. I love animals,
but I'm
not naive enough to say that nobody can eat meat because I love animals. I eat meat. And you know what? My animals eat meat. Mm-hmm. I have primarily carnivores. So where do you draw the line?
Right.
You know, like it's, you are still have leather seats in your car, or you have a leather belt, you have leather shoes or a purse, or, you know, you're not getting away from animal products.
Yeah.
Easily.
Exactly. And, you know, I have a lot of respect for the people that do, and I understand their passionate love for animals. Yeah. And so I don't ever want to say that that's wrong, but what I do see is that it's kind of coming from a place of luxury. Like in an actual crisis, you just wouldn't have access to the soybeans to make your tofu and the lettuce that you're going to need, right? So you're going to have to say, well, what is the most basic thing that I can have food-wise? And it comes back to animal protein.
Yeah. I want humane. I don't want to use even the word killing because that's sort of an oxymoron, right?
Yeah.
But I want a humane end for an animal. Like, you know, that's what I love about First Nations culture, real First Nations culture, was that sort of place in the middle of the ecosystem, the eco versus the ego, where they understood that everybody relied on each other to survive.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there would be like the buffalo hunt, and then they would, you know, pray and whatever their version of that was for the spirit of the buffalo, and then use everything on the buffalo, and, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I touched on that in the book too, that kind of nose to tail eating.
And, yeah.
You know, whether we can even talk about plants and that sort of thing in that respect. But it's that idea that everything food-wise has value, and we want to appreciate it and have gratitude for being able to consume it and the life it's lived. And then to, you know, not out of like, I'm dominating this animal and therefore I'm going to kill it. But like, I love how the animal has lived.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like you said, it's an oxymoron, but I think we have to get comfortable with that paradox of like a really good life and then like a really bad day at the end. although you know, we want to do it as humanely as possible too, right? Where there is just little to no pain involved. So that's the beauty, I think, of either raising it yourself and being really intentional with the animal's end of life, or also if, you know, I understand not every listener here is going to be able to just go out and start raising their own meat, so to find farms that are doing it on a small scale where they are devoted to their animals' welfare and well-being and caring for them so deeply, and then at the end, like, they're making it as painless and easy as possible for that animal.
So, and Karen, really, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Because we're so curious. So, Karen, at the beginning of your book, you talk about how you are not currently butchering, and then there's kind of the incident with the chicken. And but I was curious if you do more butchering now, or if you're still in that, you still outsource the butchering.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And we can get into this more too, but man, like in the seven years that we've been homesteading, we've tried out a lot of different things. And we've also realized how when you try and do it all, it's totally unsustainable. One of the things I wished I would have known coming in, and I was just so eager and so excited, and I wanted to do all the things, and I wanted to be as self-reliant as possible, so which required me to do it, right, or my family to do it. But what I realized is that if you kind of specialize in a few things really well, you'll be able to do those things and be sustainable in that way really well. And then realize that they're actually, once you start looking, there's an amazing community of people all around that are doing this to some extent. And so to support each other and say, okay, well, they're really good at, or they have pasture, let's say, to raise cows. I don't have a large enough pasture to do cattle at all, but I can do chickens or whatever, you know, and kind of work together in community that way. So at this point, I kind of hit a wall, and I would actually call it like homesteading burnout. I was so exhausted of the 24/7, the early mornings, late nights, the animal loss, when you're just desperately trying to do whatever you can to protect them from predators, and it's still predators somehow get them. Sorry, that's a really roundabout way to answer your question, Rob, but we still outsource our butchering, and actually we've stopped raising as many animals for meat and just recognize that there's other farmers with setups that are better than ours. And so we want to support them and their ventures and still have like very humanely raised meat. But there's some amazing farmers in the area that we purchase from to kind of supplement what we do.
Let's give them a shout out. Are they commercial? Like, they're not commercial, obviously, but do they sell to the public, or is it just more of a barter system?
It's more of a private thing. So I would honestly, the one farm that I will, that's kind of moving into somewhat of a commercial, is called K&M Farms, and they do poultry, and they're out in the Aldergrove area. They're amazing. I'm like, who I'm thinking of is actually just a lot of like mom and pop style, where they'll sell a few dozen eggs and, you know, maybe one or two pigs worth of meat a year, but not kind of on any commercial size.
Yeah, and there's new regulations going in right now, isn't there? There's something to do with small scale farms and the regulations, how it's going to hurt them. Can you tell us a bit about that?
The one that kind of impacts everyone that comes to mind is, when you're producing on ALR land, you need to have a certain amount of land, first of all, and then depending on the size of land that you have, you have to make a certain amount of money in order to qualify for farm status. And that's kind of something that a lot of people are interested in, because you're not making a whole lot of money.
You're selling eggs. Eggs at like whatever, $5 a dozen. That's a heck of a lot of eggs.
Yeah, I know. And so, you know, farmers are happy to break even, but then have all these tax breaks, and that's really what's helping. So getting farm status for us is pretty important, because we're saving like a few thousand dollars a year by doing that. Yeah. And so that in a way is contributing, and then all the feed write-offs and that sort of thing. So that's contributing like in a roundabout way to the income. I'm not 100% up to date with all the things that are going on with the ALR. And for people that aren't in BC or even Canada, the ALR stands for the Agricultural Land Reserve. Mm-hmm. And the government has set aside a certain number of acres for really to just be growing food. And so they want people who live in that designated land to be growing some sort or producing some sort of food or some sort of crop. The tension is that small scale farmers don't necessarily have access to abattoirs the way that large farms do, or access to just other, even grants and that sort of thing. So small farmers feel like they're definitely getting squeezed out, where the big agriculture is kind of dominating and potentially taking over.
Well, it is. It's turning into an industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an industry now that people are controlling, instead of having people that have the right to just grow their own food. I mean, it never used to be like that, right? You used to be able to buy a bottle of land, you had some chickens, you had, you know, a milking cow. So they really screwed it all up.
Yeah.
Almost to the point of no return. So Karen, you've left the city. Now you're on your homestead. You're going through having all these different experiences. When did you decide to write a book?
Yeah, it kind of came about from blogging, actually. actually. So I decided to start blogging about my adventures, and it has the same name. It's still floating around on the internet because it, you know, the internet is forever.
Forever.
Yeah, so for a few years I was blogging under the blog named Grow, Cook, Eat, Share, and just kind of talk like recipes and things we were trying. That was when we were early on into settle, even before we moved, but then when we were starting to settle and clear our land and do all the things that we needed to do to get set up. So it was kind of that fun, like, look at what we're doing. We're starting from scratch and growing and building, and our vision is coming to life sort of thing. And that started to taper off just because, man, it's hard to do a lot of writing and homestead at the same time.
Yeah.
Right.
But it turns out there is a small publisher down in Virginia who came across my blog, and he was really, it's just a one-man show really, but he was really intrigued by what we were doing and what we were writing. And so he got in touch with me. And I know this is kind of like unheard of these days, but he just said, I think you've got a book in you and I'd like to publish it for you. And wow. My jaw hit the floor. And at first I'm like, oh, like this is cruel spam emails. Like that they know that I want to be a writer and I'd love to write a book someday. And they're just like really giving it to me here. But I Googled him and I had a lawyer look over the contract, and we spent a few hours chatting back and forth in a few phone calls, and kind of realized, yeah, I guess this is the real deal. He'd had other books published by other authors as well as himself. So I decided to take the leap. And so from day one, I had a publisher that I was working with, and he also worked on the developmental editing with me, which was so essential. I never would have realized how critical a developmental editor was until I actually began the process. But yeah, that was the beginning of my book.
So how long from like, okay, I'm going to go ahead and write the book to actually publishing the book did it take?
Yeah, it was, for me, it was a 2.5 year process. And I mean, right? Like it takes time and people live lives. Most people can't just be holed up writing for 12 hours a day. I mean, even if you try, like you can't exactly sit at a desk and write for 12 hours. So yeah, the original contract was for a year. And as we kept inching closer, I'm like, you know, I'm just not going to have it ready. And he kept saying, that's okay. Like quality is more important than quantity at this point. So if we need to extend it, we'll extend it. So he was great to work with, super patient. I mean, there was a lot of handholding going on because this was my first book as well. So, you know, when he criticized something I'd submit, I would just like take a few days to kind of recover and, you know, lick my wounds before I come back with a response to him. So, yeah.
And what was your writing process like? Did you outline your chapters? Did you have an idea how it was going to be? Did you hide under the desk for a day and just hope everything would turn out okay?
I love that. Yeah, I did a lot of hiding under the desk.
I'm under the desk right now. I'm just kidding. Right.
No.
So you did. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would just say I'm a bit more of a planner than a pantser. So okay. I definitely started with. And I wanted to kind of have an idea of where it was going. Although I didn't, when I started, I didn't know that it was going to evolve into a 4 seasons. That kind of emerged about halfway through. Mm-hmm. I just had a list of chapter ideas. That was basically how I went about it and knew kind of what each chapter was going to be. But it's funny because I'd submitted the first few chapters and got approval and everything was going great. And then I submitted the next one and my publisher / editor right away said, no, this is a different book you started writing. This one's off the table. And I was thinking like, oh no, because half the chapters were going to be like this. What on earth am I supposed to do now? So that was like the first big sucker punch. that was probably the one where my ego got hurt the hardest.
How did How did you push through that? How did you push past that?
Honestly, like, there were a few tears, and I chatted with a few people that know me, and just, I was a little bit at a loss, like, where am I going to go from here if he doesn't want this kind of writing? And it was more like what we talked about earlier, a bit of the kind of, you know, taking that stand and saying, okay, this is the value of small scale farming, and this is why we should do it, right? And a little more preachy, I guess. And he was like, no, let's keep the preachy out of it. Let's just tell your story. And so after a few days, like, my cortisol finally exited my body. I was a little calmer. And I said, okay, I think I can do this. And so it was back to the drawing board. It was like, what now? Because I didn't want to just write without knowing if I could fill a book. I wanted to be sure I could fill a book. And so that was probably like 2 or 3 months into the process was when I just really for a few days hit it hard and said, okay, well, what are my chapters going to be about? How am I going to tell my story? And his idea was, you're not writing a how to homestead book, you're writing a why to homestead book by telling your story. And that's when I came up with the chapters that are in the book, and then the rest kind of just flowed from there. Well, the rest trickled from there.
Ebbs and flows, yeah.
Go ahead, Rob.
I wanted to know, so out of that whole process, what do you think was the best advice you got as a writer that you would then pass on to other writers?
Oh, that's a good question. Hire a developmental editor. I wasn't told that, but if you can't afford to hire one, get some people around you that have a decent head on their shoulders to kind of be the beta readers all along. Just, you know, so that you know you're going to resonate with readers, so that you know that your story is coherent and that one chapter ties in with the next. Even in my case, because it's nonfiction, it's not like one chapter flows into the next. It's a little bit, they could potentially stand alone, but you still want to see those overarching themes. So I think that's probably one of the critical learning pieces that I walked away with from that experience.
And did you know, it's funny because my editor lives in Abbotsford too.
Okay.
Yeah, she's amazing. And you found a good one that you liked that you could work with and...
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah.
Who are your favorite writers and your favorite books growing up? And did they have an influence on your writing?
Oh, Kari, that's such a hard question. There are so many.
Pick your top three. Hello?
Oh, did we lose her?
I don't know. Yeah, she didn't want to answer that question.
That was too tough. That one was too tough.
I'm going to go. And...
Hello.
Oh, we got her back. We got her back.
Oh, I'm so sorry about that. I'm not sure what happened there.
That's okay. We assumed the question just blew your iPhone's mind, and there was just no way to move forward from there. So.
Totally.
Just so your video's on now as well, just so you know, okay. Your video's on. You look very pretty.
Oh, thanks. I don't know how to shut it off. So if
that's
okay.
Don't worry about it. We're good to see it. So you were going to tell us your top three. You were going to tell us who your... Oh, we got a bit of a delay.
Oh, okay. How's it working now? Do you
That's
want
good.
Me to log off and log back on again?
Okay.
Awesome. Top three?
Yes.
So my probably all-time favorite writer is Wendell Berry. His poetry is amazing. His prose is amazing. His kind of understanding of nature and human nature is amazing, and so he is like at the top of my list, definitely. And I write nonfiction, and it's kind of funny. Like, I just mostly read nonfiction as well.
That makes sense.
So I wouldn't say that I've got, I wouldn't say that I've got a ton of fiction authors that I love. Although I will say, like, one of my favorite books of all time that was fiction was The Kite Runner.
That's a great book.
Right. And he has a bit of, it almost feels like he's writing creative nonfiction. I don't know for sure how much of his life and his background he brought into the book, but I think he did bring so much into it of himself.
Yeah. Life in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read And the Mountains Echoed?
No, I haven't.
Just as good. So is his second book. I can't remember what it was called, but it was about the two wives. Miriam was the one. Do you remember the second book by him?
Is that something about the sun? I don't remember.
Yes, it is.
A Thousand Splendid Suns.
Yes, that's it. Yes.
You got me there. You said sun, writer. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can get there.
he's one of my favorite writers. His writing is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So poetic and said, Rob, lyrical. Like, I literally was underlining sentences in his book as I was reading. I'm like, this sentence is so beautiful.
He's gorgeous. Do you think that any of those writers had an influence? Because your writing is lovely. I could see like your lush green fields, and when your husband was angry with the rooster, I could see him like just marching with that axe, like just, you know. I just got attacked by my rooster, so I got a special little satisfaction out of that chapter. Can I tell you? Yeah, he just had a go at me. I felt the same way about many spots in your book as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Are you, so in that vein, are you working on a new book?
You know, can I say I'm working on like 10 new books?
Sure.
Yeah.
So let me cut in just real quick with a quick story. So I love Gilmore Girls, loved it. I love the kind of mini movie end of the whole series kind of thing but the one thing that bugged me about it was when they asked her, okay, you know, what pieces do you have? And she couldn't whip out like 8 different ideas right there. Cause I have not yet met a writer who doesn't have 8 different stories that they're sitting on, that they're just like kind of in a developmental hell. So you can say you've got 10 things. I totally believe that.
Yeah. What do you want to write next?
I mean, that's equally tricky. So one of the things that, like a few that come to mind that I really want to write one day, and I just don't know when or what order it's going to be, a memoir about my journey with generalized anxiety disorder. That's been a pretty, it's been completely like a part of my life, my whole life. So I definitely want to at some point write a memoir about that. I also have a story that was an event that my grandfather experienced. And so I'd love to write a historical fiction novel around that. And that I actually spent like quite a few months outlining and developing characters, and fiction is really out of my comfort zone. So I felt like I needed to be more prepared. And then I kind of got to a place and I just thought, you know, I'm not sure if I'm ready to write this book yet. I think I need to actually develop my writing skills a little more before I start a fiction novel, as opposed to just short stories. So right now I write a lot of short stories and I write a lot of poetry, and I would love to at some point also write, create a collection of a book of poetry, and then potentially a book of short stories as well. So those are what come to mind when you ask me that.
I can't wait to see what you put out in the future.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So I think when we spoke earlier, you said that you have kind of stepped. Oh, I just dropped my microphone. Good thing I'm not on camera. You said that you had kind of stepped away from homesteading a little bit.
A little, yeah. And it goes back to that idea of burnout.
Yeah.
I really didn't realize what a toll that kind of venture takes on a person. Like physically, you know that you get tired. And, you know, it's ironic because here I was trying to create the sustainable homestead as far as animals and plants and permaculture and all of that. And what I didn't realize is that the way I was going about it, the work that I was putting into it, the long hours, the 24/7, the, you know, not a whole lot of outside support, it wasn't sustainable for me to keep doing it that way. And I'm the farmer. Like, just to clarify, my husband supports me and does work when I ask him to. He lifts the 100-pound bales because I can't, but I'm the farmer. So,
okay.
So it was on my shoulders. And the more I took on, as exciting as it was and adventurous as it was, because I got to, you know, try yet another thing, I didn't recognize my own limitations, and I just really kind of hit a wall and realized I had to pull back and pick what was the most important to me, because I just realized I couldn't do it all.
Well, yeah, because you've got two kids as well, right?
I have four kids.
Four yeah. kids! Oh, yeah. My goodness. How do you even have time for anything else?
I don't understand. Them to work.
Yeah, I guess so. What's the point of having kids if it's free labor, right? I mean,
right?
That's...
I know. Like, they've got to learn life skills. The easiest way to have the birds and bees conversation is to take them out to watch the goats in fall, right? When goats are in rut. So there you go. Like, lesson learned, kiddos.
Do you still have your bees?
Oh, Kari. I tried 3 years in a row to keep my bees alive over winter, and I failed every spring to find living bees in my hives. And I've done treatments, I've done research, I've had our provincial bee guy come out and do a health check on my bees. Like, I feel like I've done it all right. I took a course before, a 12-week course.
Yeah.
That provincially certified before I even got my first hives.
You're next, yeah. And you just couldn't keep them over winter, eh? I had a wasp. Pardon? Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just no. It's just for me, that was just something I couldn't do.
No. Well, you live and learn, right? Like, this is how you learn what your capabilities are. So now if you have eggs, you can trade that for honey with a honey farmer, with somebody who is able to dedicate that, you know.
Yeah.
That soul thing.
Yeah. And let me tell you, and this is what I think everyone should do, is I have such a deep appreciation for honey now in a way that I never would have before, even though I knew the labor, like I saw other people do it that I know. But to have tried and failed and put so much into it and, you know, still not have been able to be successful, other than we were able to harvest like maybe a liter each year. But such a small amount for all the work that goes into it. And then to still, you know, lose your bees and have to buy them again.
They're expensive.
They're expensive. Not
yeah. We had a wasp. There was a war that we didn't even know about was going on. And the wasps attacked our hive, and we didn't even know. We went there this spring, opened it up. They were all dead. And you could see like the wasps in with them.
Mm-hmm.
So the bees fought valiantly, but in the end the wasps are just too larger, they're stronger, they're meaner, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was, and that's one of the things about farms and homesteading that they don't show you on Instagram is death.
Yeah.
There's a lot of death. There's a lot of, I hate to use the word fail, but there's a lot of learning curves that go along with it, and they're expensive.
Yeah.
They're heartbreaking. They're, you know, when a president, we had a weasel get into the hen house,
mm-hmm.
you know, we've had raccoons get into the hen house. We just had to chase a bear off a few days ago. You know, you have to be constantly vigilant when you have livestock on your property outside, you know, it's, you know, so there's a lot of stuff that they don't show you that goes along with going out and finding dead animals or you know, that is hard, that you really have to sort of, because, you know, you get all the guilt and you get all the stuff that goes along with that, that you really have to learn how to come to terms with that, with yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I touch on it in the book too, but even when events like that happen too, you're not only dealing with your own guilt or questioning yourself, you're also dealing with people that are questioning what you're doing, close friends and family. They're like, are you done yet? Like, when are you moving back to the city or to the suburbs? Like, when are you giving up this pipe dream? And there's not a whole lot of support and appreciation for people that you feel like they should want to cheer you on. So
I'm sorry to hear that. You get most of the support from other farmers.
Yeah,
is where it comes from. People who understand, because people who, you know, sort of live in the city or live in a condo and shop at IGA, they don't, if they could see, and I tell people that when people, you know, have these debates about hunting, because I'm pro hunting. I'm not trophy hunting, but I am pro hunting. I am pro going out and getting your meat from the woods, bringing it home, taking it to the, you know, the butchers who do that all up for you. And people, you know, oh, that's so cruel and all, oh, there's lots of meat in the grocery stores. And it's like, well, go visit an abattoir and see what happens. You know what I mean? Like, see, you know, it's, so there's that whole debate, which is like another show, but,
for sure.
But I don't think people really have an idea where their food comes from. You know,
and so for people to actually, you know, like, we attempted to raise bees and that didn't work out for us, but for people to even either go to a working farm and just volunteer for a summer in exchange for a CSA, or to, you know, raise a batch of chicks in your yard, even if you end up selling them off when they're older, right? If you can't keep them in your backyard, or breed rabbits for a season, like all of these things, and not in a flippant way of like, I don't care what the
problem
is, but education comes from, like, to know how hard you have to work to actually produce your food. And people think, oh, I have to drive like 30 kilometers to the nearest Costco or whatever, like, that's such an inconvenience. Well, raise your food for a season. Inconvenience.
Funny story about raising rabbits. That's how my husband got me. When we first met each other, you know, we added each other on Facebook. And, you know, I was, you know, of course you're interested in the person and you're going through their photos, and he had all these photos of bunnies. And I was like, oh my God, I love him. He has bunnies. And then, you know, so I'm going through, oh, there's a cute bunny. There's a cute bunny. And then there's a picture of like a piece of meat on a smoker. And I'm like, oh, he doesn't have, those aren't pets.
So, that's awesome.
He had I never, and when I came over, he made, like, because he likes to smoke food and stuff, and so he had smoked some of the rabbit, which he said was just absolutely delicious, and, you know, made it for me for dinner one night when I came over. And I was like, you know, I don't know, thank you, you know? Which is totally hypocritical. Which is totally hypocritical, because it's, you know, it's the same as a cow or a pig or a, or you know, it's the same thing. And same with cultures, you know, everybody gets so angry with different cultures who eat different kinds of foods, and it's like, but they're all animals, it's the same thing.
Yeah,
you know. And that's one thing that really burns me about vegetarians and vegans is like, well, when you go to other countries, people don't have that option. They don't have a grocery store on every on every corner, right? So you have to be mindful when you're saying that everyone's horrible for eating meat or eating fish. You know, it's not the same everywhere else.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So what do you have in store for the future then, Karen? What do you, what do you got down, coming down the pipe for yourself?
I mean, homesteading wise right now, we're scaling back. So we've got a bit of a smaller garden, a little more manageable. We've still got our chickens for eggs. I have one pet goat that I love. So he's just a pet on our property for now. That's, we're kind of just reevaluating. We're really deciding like what is worth it for us. How can we support other local farmers if we decide not to, which there are so many of, so So yeah. We feel really fortunate in that sense that there are people near us that we can support. But I've kind of taken a break a little bit from writing in a sense too, because I have recently been working on becoming a life coach. So that's something a little different.
Nice.
But I think it still ties into the writing in the sense that I've been blogging a bit again, just simple stuff, writing about, things that relate to life coaching. So that's been a really fun new adventure for me.
Do you think you'll write a book about life coaching?
I hope so at some point. right now I feel like a lot of my knowledge is theoretical and I haven't been doing it long, so I haven't worked with that many clients. So I'd really like to get some life experience. What I'm realizing is that, and I mean, homesteading, whatever, right? Like, you learn by doing. You can read as many books as you want and still not really know what you're doing until you just go out and do it. Mm-hmm. So at first I felt like, oh, I can't take clients on. Like, I don't have enough experience yet. I felt all stressed about that, or, oh, I should get another certificate or specialize in this. And I just came to the realization, like, I just have to coach clients. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the biggest lesson right there. One day, I hope so, but I definitely want to get some experience under my belt before then.
Awesome.
I think that's very admirable. I think people need connection, and a lot of people don't think about having a life coach. You know, you go to school and you learn, you know, how to do math and stupid calculus, which I failed, and how to conjugate a verb. But you don't know how to deal with your emotion. You're not taught how to deal with emotional things. You're not taught how to manage a paycheck or pay taxes or and so I think this whole surge of like people starting to look to other people for life coaching is wonderful, especially if it's a peer, because oftentimes your parents are just a different generation and you don't have that. You don't have the same connection in the sense that they don't understand, you know, how things work oftentimes in the world today. You can go to your parents for some things, but I think the life coach profession is a very admirable one. It's for your emotions, right?
Absolutely. And that's my focus. Other people focus on different things. You know, there are career coaches where they're going to help set people up on a career trajectory. There's executive coaches that work within organizations to support employees and that sort of thing. And that's great. That's kind of where coaching started. But it's true, what you said, Kari, I love how it's moving towards this more personal development side where people are realizing, we don't have a lot of skills talking about our emotions because culturally, like, that's not something we do. And so our parents didn't learn how to do that and didn't model that or teach that to us. So I agree. It's so important. Like, when you know how to manage and regulate your emotions and how to talk about them with others, your communication improves, your relationships improve, your life satisfaction increases. So there's a lot of value to that, definitely.
And how to make choices. Yeah. And how to, right? And to how to come to terms with those choices and how to forgive yourself. Because not everybody wants to go to counseling or have a psychiatrist or have a psychologist. There's a whole stigma attached to mental health, which is, again, another show. So I think that life coaches sort of offer that happy medium of just having somebody to talk to that's skilled, that can help you. So, you know, what an admirable profession to get into. And that's all the time we have for today. So I'm going to wrap up the show. What a lovely book. What a great experience this has been. Thank you so much.
Let's name the book one more time.
You know, it's a lovely book. She's got recipes in there, little anecdotes. She's even got some like herb medicinal. So it really covers everything. If you're interested even a tiny bit in farming, homesteading, even doomsday preppers will like this book. There's things about growing vegetables. There's things about, you know, finding medicinal herbs and making medicines, raising animals, eggs, honey. So it just really covers a broad spectrum of subjects and all packed into this one lovely little book called Grow, Cook, Eat, Share by Karen Jansen. And we're going to have a little poll and a little giveaway on the Facebook page when we put the show out, which is going to be soon. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay.
We're still here.
We're here.
Rob, and thank you so much for coming on the show. Karen, it was lovely to have you.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thanks for giving me a voice to share my story and my book. And I hope your listeners really enjoy learning more about homesteading.
It really was. It was wonderful to have you. And that's our show for April, folks. Until then, keep reading.
Bye, everybody.